hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. It's a busy summer lunchtime in London's Bloomsbury, and we're within a stone's throw of where Charles Dickens once lived. I'm in the company of Matthew Beaumont, a scholar and professor in English literature at University College London, and author of the best-selling book called Night Walking, A Nocturnal History of London. His research interests go far beyond literature, and he's also co-director of the university's Urban Lab, where he's responsible for the city's Imagine strand. My first question is, how long did it take you to write Night Walking, and when did you begin, and what prompted you to start?
It probably took me about 2 years from beginning to end, but I've been thinking about it for quite a long time. It would have taken a lot longer, I think, if I hadn't been given a year's research fellowship. I've been thinking about it for probably 5-6 years. My specialism is 19th century literature and early 20th century, and in fact originally my book, the Night Walking book, was going to be about, above all, the 19th and 20th centuries, and Dickens was the sort of the be-all and the end-all in a way. I mean, not quite, but he was certainly the beginning of it.
He's been hammered out a lot, though, hasn't he?
He's been hammered out a lot, and I ended up, you know, writing a book that finished with Dickens rather than started with Dickens, because I realised that there was this older, more hidden story to tell about London at night. But I'm quite looking forward, I have to say, to going on and doing stuff about London and indeed other cities.
Is there a plan?
Walking, yeah, in the 19th and 20th centuries, to write the book that I failed to write the first time round, as it were.
So what was the book you intended to write?
Well, the book I intended to write was about a 19th and 20th century bohemian tradition, pure and simple. Those who inhabited London at night wrote about it. When I started seriously researching the book, Night Walking, I realised that there was this legal category of the so-called common night walker, and that it had existed since at least the late 13th century. So I was then forced, really, to go all the way back to the Middle Ages in order to look at these figures who walked in London at night.
So at one time there was a legal entity called Common Night Walker.
That's okay. Absolutely right. So in 1285, Edward I introduced a statute called the Night Walker Statute, part of the Statute of Winchester, and the point of it was really to find a way of policing England at a time when crime levels were rising. Crime levels were rising in the late 13th century because really of the onset of agrarian capitalism, because the land was being enclosed and poor people, farm labourers, were being thrown off the land. So there were waves of immigration to London and indeed to other towns and cities, and the crime rates were going up, or at least there was the perception that the crime rates were going up. The Night Walker statute was all about trying to police these itinerant, migrant, often vagrant individuals in the city at night. Anyone who broke the curfew had been introduced by William I in 1068, I think, shortly after the Norman Conquest. It was felt in the late 13th century that because of this vagrant and migrant population, because there was so much unemployment in the cities, in London above all, that there had to be some kind of mechanism in place legally for containing them and for policing them. So it was really a statute that gave night watchmen powers to arrest people simply for wandering around on the streets at night. What's interesting about the way in which London historically has been policed is that nothing much changes from the late 13th century all the way up to the early 19th century when the Metropolitan Police is introduced and the system is professionalised. And indeed, technically speaking, the Night Walker statute remains on the books until then. Indeed, it remained nominally on the books until the late 1960s, that word night walker. You can still technically be arrested in the late 1960s for being a night walker in London.
You've suddenly moved from English literature into social geography, sociology, criminal history, sorts of things.
Yeah, that was one of the things that was fun. So I started off with a quite narrow literary historical remit, and indeed that is my background, but I realised that in order to do justice to this topic of walking at night, I had to delve very deeply into social history.
I mean, that's the sort of thing I thought. There must be sort of the contextual stuff, especially with the sort of kind of moving people from the land, the enclosures, agrarian, the industrial revolution, but also the kind of practical things. When did we have, windows in our houses? And then when did we start lighting the streets? Because, I mean, I imagine you're fondling your way through the dark, aren't you?
You are, unless there's a moon.
I mean, you know, what you're trying to do is actually to be hidden. I mean, don't you walk at night to be hidden rather than to reveal yourself?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you walk at night because in order to be hidden, or in order, as the authorities feared, to get up to no good of one kind or another, or simply because you feel homeless in the city in the day, and it's the only place where you've got any kind of peace, I suppose. The public lighting first gets introduced in London in the late 17th century, just fractionally after other European cities like Paris and Lille and other sort of metropolitan spots. But it's really the 18th century when a culture of nightlife, as we'd understand it now, I think, emerges.
Let's take the writers and the poets. Did you make your living from writing? I mean, in those days, I'm not sure, but if you did make your living from writing in those days, writing by candlelight and quill pen, I imagine, is hard work. So you sort of write during daylight and find your inspiration or contemplation by walking out at night.
It's true that the conditions in which you could work, in which you could write or indeed read at night were pretty difficult in the 17th and 18th century as they had been before. The 18th century, the time when nightlife emerges, is the period in which the professional poet also appears, when professional writers as a kind of social category emerges. And these were people associated with Grub Street, Grub Street poets, who were effectively writing by the word, writing by the yard, who were producing copy for the periodicals, for this boom in magazines and newspapers. But a lot of them had aspirations to be poets and to be taken very seriously, even though they lived in extreme poverty, often alongside completely marginalised social groups, you know, Jewish people, prostitutes, foreigners of one kind or another, in the more squalid bits of the old city of London. Some of them, of course, were not just aspirant poets, but at least became truly great poets. I mean, or writers, people like Samuel Johnson, people like Oliver Goldsmith, and those figures, I mean, above all, perhaps those two, used to go out and walk at night, in fact.
And they really started the romanticising of walking.
That's
almost
true.
Walking in the city, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Yes, I'd say so.
Because they weren't walking in the city because they had to get from A to B, or necessarily find somewhere to sleep for shelter. They were walking for inspiration, pleasure, contemplation, curiosity.
I think that's right. They were walking for inspiration, and that renders them, if you like, proto-romantic. I mean, even though there's an urban setting, they anticipate some of the investments, as it were, the spiritual, moral, political investments that the Romantics later imparted to, in a rural context, to walking. They also, people like Johnson, Goldsmith, in the 18th century, used walking at night in particular, as a way of surveying the city, excavating the underside of this kind of boastful, glorious civilization that everyone was told that, you know, they had to be kind of proud of. And, you know, London was becoming an imperial centre, a commercial centre. People like Johnson and Goldsmith were very suspicious of this, and they felt that the clearest indication that you could get that actually all was not well, that England wasn't the place that its rulers pretended it was by going out at night, seeing the extreme poverty of homeless people, seeing the desperation of sex workers, as we'd call them, kind of when the makeup of the city, you know, and the cosmetic look of the city had kind of disappeared when you know, after the city.
Okay, are you a bit of a nocturnal creature yourself?
I am. I mean, I've certainly done a fair amount of night walking myself, but I do find that the older I get, the more keen I am to get to bed if I can. But yeah, I've certainly done a fair amount of walking at night in London and indeed out of London.
The life of the person who is homeless, because they fear attack in darkness, that they're actually walking around in darkness while they're asleep in day. Yeah. Now, was that something that's been the case for hundreds of years?
There is a long line of people, you know, stretching back to those vagrants I've already mentioned in the Middle Ages, of people who are homeless at night and who keep on the move in order to make themselves, as you rightly put it, you know, less vulnerable. In the book, I, with deliberate exaggeration, in order to make a polemical point, I say that homelessness has no history. And of course, you know, the way in which homeless people have been supported or not by the state or by charities and that kind of thing has evolved over the course of centuries in places like London. But there's a sense, nonetheless, I think, in which the very basic experience of being homeless, of either trying to sleep on the streets or of walking the streets in order to remain warm and free from harassment, has changed not one jot since the Middle Ages, since these so-called common night walkers were first persecuted by the police.
Maybe I should ask you about the coming of the pedestrian, because pedestrian is a word I think you mentioned in the book, and you know, one always thinks of a writer who writes rather in a rather pedestrian style, and yet it was a word itself that was sort of taken and then applied to people who walked. So how did that all come together?
Yeah, that's right. It's a very curious situation, sort of semantically speaking, I think, that, because as you say, it starts off as a description of prose, and then migrates to describe people walking. One would think it was exactly the reverse of that. I mean, the cult of pedestrianism really doesn't come in until the Romantic period. I mean, there are other people who are much more authoritative on this than me and have written much more and much better on this than me, but it's associated in a rural context, in particular with Romantic poets like Coleridge and Wordsworth. But they are nonetheless inheriting that urban tradition of pedestrianism that we've already touched on, associated with Grub Street, because, as I maybe already indicated, there was a political investment in that pedestrianism in the 18th century in London from people like Goldsmith and Johnson and Richard Savage. They were making a kind of class stand by going on foot, and they were deliberately resisting the enticement, the temptation to go by carriage. I mean, many of them, of course, including Johnson, when he was a young man, couldn't afford anyway to go by coach or by horse or whatever it was. But it was a sort of resentful stand against a culture which didn't prioritise the simple activity of putting one foot in front of another, and which rejected a culture too that seemed detached from the life of the city going on around it, because it was elevated, because it was moving at relative speed through the streets. So it was walking became a kind of affirmation of the city itself, I think, and of the poor of the city, the ordinary lives of the city in the 18th century. And there's a sense in which that then gets transposed to the rural context with romantics like Coleridge and Wordsworth, who are walking through, you know, North Wales and the Lake District in order to make a kind of class point themselves, in order to assert their own sort of de classe status, as well as in order to affirm nature.
The body of work we have in terms of literature is very male, but we mustn't overlook the fact that the people who walked at night were both men and women.
That's absolutely true. You're right that it's partly that the literary and the historical record is for the most part written by men, and that's excluded women. But there's another sense in which actually, in historiographical terms, and in terms of our understanding of the past, I suppose, actually been much more work done on women, on prostitutes in particular, than there has on male or even non-male and female vagrants walking. So one of the things my book was trying to do was redress that balance slightly. Not, of course, to say that the history of prostitution wasn't incredibly important, but to say, look, we've overlooked the fact that originally night walking was an activity that both men and women could be prosecuted for, that it wasn't gendered in the way that we think it, you know, we might assume it is today. I mean, originally, night walking didn't mean, as it's probably come to mean, street walking. You know, it's nonetheless true to say that women are that much more restricted than men, at least since the early modern period in their movements at night, not least because to be out on the streets at all was effectively to make yourself liable to the charge of being a prostitute, whoever you were. Men were less vulnerable and were less susceptible to misogynistic or patriarchal stereotyping than women.
Yeah. And certainly walking individually, independently as a woman is a very, very challenging situation. We're still in a very gendered city.
I quite agree. I did an event with Will Self when the book came out in hardback, and he came up with a brilliant idea in relation to a question from someone in the audience about the gendered nature of the city and the gendered nature of walking today, and he suggested that a curfew should be imposed for men for, you know, X number of nights in the year, so that all men would be cleared from the streets and would have to remain at home, so that women could go out without fear of harassment. We would be free to enjoy the streets, which is something that men, to a much greater extent, as you say, can already. I mean, there are other socially marginalised groups for whom the city is also a much more political space at night, in particular, you know, black and Asian people. You know, obviously, this, you know, the prevailing kind of social climate, racial politics of the time make a big difference here. But if you think of, you know, London in the 1980s and how difficult it was to be a black person out after dark because you'd be picked up under the sus law and harassed, imprisoned, etc. You know, if you think of Asian people today, you know, you're an Asian man with a rucksack on, walking at night when no one else is around, probably for all the wrong reasons, you're going to arouse the suspicion of the police. So women, but also other social minorities, are subject to this.
Did you find, while you were doing your research, one person that resonated with you more than another?
I think, cliche though it might be, that I'd have to say it was Dickens, with whom I found it easiest to immerse myself. That, you know, he was such a compulsive walker. He was such an extensive walker. He was such a speedy walker. He was such a neurotic walker. You know, he, immersing yourself in his walking, in the kind of psychology of his walking, in the politics of his walking, and he did do a lot of walking at night as well as in the day, is kind of irresistible, I think. You know, you get dragged very deep into his life and into its darker recesses in the late 1850s when his marriage was breaking down. So he'd walk from, certainly on one night, he did a walk from 30 or so miles from the square that we're in right now, Tavistock Square, down to Gadshill Place, his house in Kent. He was, you know, hallucinating with tiredness by the end. He maintained his extraordinary pace of 4.5 miles an hour, which is really quite remarkable, particularly over long, long distances like that.
That's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, and he was in sort of late middle age by Victorian standards by this time.
He was one of these people who do 100 miles in 24 hours.
Yeah. He was the Eddie Izzard of his day, doing kind of crazy walking feats. And in fact, actually, incidentally and interestingly, you know, the early 19th century was very much the period of where walking as an athletic activity became fashionable. And he rather liked the idea, Dickens, I think, that he was in a line of people like Captain Barclay who had performed these remarkable walking feet.
So is this something that are we going too slowly?
My partner tells me that I'm a very quick walker.
Do you actually go out for a walk to find inspiration yourself?
I think naturally I walk relatively quickly, and so I probably have to self-consciously slow myself down and in order to open myself out, as the flaneurs did in 19th century Paris, to my surroundings.
Are you someone who has to walk every day and you have to walk a certain distance?
I certainly feel very itchy if I haven't walked at all in the day, even if they're fairly routine walks. And if they are fairly routine walks, then I walk as quickly as I possibly can. I pound about the streets. I very quickly miss, I'm sure you're the same, Andrew, that, you know, very quickly miss that sense of impact of my feet on the pavement or the ground. I don't feel right in myself unless my feet are sort of pounding and, away at the surface
and
of the ground.
Are you someone who likes to go for long walks too? Or
I do, yeah. No,
and
I
are they through the city or just also in the countryside?
No, also
too?
In the countryside, yeah. No,
you define walkers at night. You had two expressions, and I'm not going to be able to pronounce either.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I argue that there are, well, that we could classify night walkers into two types. One is the noctivagant, which is, and, you know, now obviously an anachronistic term, but that's the lower class walker, the common night walker, the vagrant, the prostitute, etc. And the etymology there is, as that vagant suggests, is close to vagrancy. And then there's the noctambulant, that's the alternative term, which is for the more, for the upper or middle class walker, for the more, the one who can kind of perambulate, you know, at their leisure, more like the flaneur or like some figure anticipating the flaneur. So yeah, we've got the noctivagant and the noctambulant, and there's a war going on in the city between noctivagants and noctambulants.
Can you recommend a walk or two for listeners?
Well, the walks I most enjoyed doing when I was researching the book, the night walks I most enjoyed doing, were ones where I followed underground rivers. Yeah, so starting up at the Heath, following, say, the River Westbourne or the River Tyburn down through North London. Both of those go through parks, Hyde Park, Regent's Park, which take you through a very interesting surface route, reminding you that the city's built on hills and fields and the like. Yeah, and you end up at the River Thames. Take the night bus home.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Matthew Beaumont. If you have any views on this interview or on any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.